Hey everyone, happy Monday, and it's a futuristic Monday today. We're going to be talking about superhuman AI, invasion of the drone body snatchers, as well as carbon counting. It's 2024. What else can we do? You're watching TechStrong Gang. Hi, everyone. Happy Monday to you. Welcome here to the TechStrong Gang. As I mentioned in the opening, we've got some really kind of futuristic, topics we're going to be hitting on today. But of course, the future is now. And so they're very timely. Let me introduce you, though, to our gang for today. First of all, joining us from the road up in New York, the one and only John Willis. John, welcome. Welcome back to TechStrong Gang.
Hey, gang. What's up?
Very well, good here. Pleasure to have you here, John. Joining John and I is our Echo Insights editor and a professional, when it comes to carbon and climate change and so forth, Bonnie Schneider. Welcome, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. And then last but not least, again, hailing from the Bronx. Bats left, throws right.
Batting 348.
Yep, batting 340. Oh, it's early in the season. We'll see. Talk to me after the All-Star break. Our chief content officer, Mike Vizard.
It's clearly Yankee celebration day, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The Yanks are back. But, we could do another show on baseball. We're going to have to focus on what we've got on our tech strong agenda today. Mike, I wanted to kick it over to you on this superhuman AI story.
Yeah, it turns out that the State Department is issuing some sort of framework document that suggests that the AI may spin out of beyond our control and there's all kinds of calamities that may ensue. And it's theoretical, but they're calling for the government to start preparing for that possibility. And secondarily, you're seeing the UN is calling for a ban on any AI system that violates human rights, but the definition of that will be hard to say. But John, I know you've been following this space closely. What is your sense of, how much are we concerned about maybe these systems spinning out of our human control? Because theoretically, the most important job in the world could be the guy standing next to the plug, right?
Yeah. Well, so I was wondering if the guys can do the wavy Scooby-Doo thing to say that I'm really not that scared. Yeah, I read the report. It's a couple of interesting things. I think they conflate this, depending on whose definition, there's sort of three definitions of AI, right? There's just AI, what they call narrow AI, which, sort of the Siri, all the sort of expert systems. There's what they call AGI, right? Which is theoretically where they call that sort of like a strong AI. And that's sort of where the computers or the AI are matching human capability, but very sort of focused plan. And then the questions come up with, can the machines learn? Can the machines, use examples? Can they plan? The experts would still argue that we're not at AGI yet, right? I think that's an interesting debate. We're somewhere between AI and AGI, depending on what you're thinking about. But this article and then the report conflates AGI with the third category, which is superintelligence. And that, there's still about a 50, I'll just use my numbers. There's a half debate of the experts that say that we're not AGI yet. In fact, Elon Musk's lawsuit against OpenAI is based on that he claims that once we made AGI, they were supposed to turn it all back to open source, right? And that's a whole nother. So, but the article really just says AGI, but it throws in superintelligence periodically. I don't think anybody believes superintelligence is an issue right now. I mean, it's phenomenal what these machines are doing. But when they use things like, power seeking and, like the HAL, like the sort of the 2001 Space Odyssey, like, it won't allow us to turn it off. Yeah, it's run by electricity, and I was thinking about this too. Like, I worked with a large financial institution, right? I mean, they've been doing algo trading forever. You know, Knight Capital story, right, is a company that literally an Al Gore in an exchange literally went wild and you know, they went out of business in 24 hours. So it's like $400 million in like 45 minutes. I mean, how banks deal with that, they have border routers. So OpenAI has border routers. You basically turn them off, you know, and guess what? It can't take over the world. If there's like, you know, if they've got, you know, a number of border routers and you and any responsible organization and most of their infrastructure, from what I hear, is run by Microsoft. They're going to have kill switches on routers. And, you know, and again, you turn electricity off. One other point, Mark, is that I went and read the report, and that report is written by it was all written by the one company. You know, the what is it, the Glacier or the Gladstone AI. So all the three authors of that paper were Gladstone AI. Well, if you look at Gladstone's website, they sell AI. You know, so I like, and the fact that, you know, all the sort of UN and US government was sort of, you know, pointing to this paper is, you know, I was expecting to see a consortium of like, you know, industry experts, maybe like a Josh Corman on it or something like that. And, you know, and then last but not least, you know, like I think their outline, you know, like one of them is basically, outlaw open source of advanced AI. I mean, that's exactly the opposite of what you want to. It's open. If there's any savior, if there is an ASI coming in the future, or if AGI gets so crazy that we can't manage it, I mean, anybody who's playing with this stuff right now will tell you that the answer is to have the models open, so we can see how they're weighed. We can see how we can at least, we'll never understand how they're working at scale, but at least we have a chance, a fighting chance. But if it's just, if it's, you know, OpenAI and it's Amazon running Claude or Anthropic code, you know, like then we, you know, now we can't even tell what's going on. So, yeah. So I think there's a little bit of hype. I think we've been sort of mentally trained of this whole like sci-fi universe with this stuff. But I'll just end with the, you know, there are phenomenal things going on in these like neural networks, and the people who have built them and maintain them will tell you they don't really understand how they're doing the things they do. So I don't know what the right answer is, but I'm really not that worried.
Look, anybody who sits, who thinks that they're going to, you know, lay down on the railroad tracks and stop the AI train.
Yeah, that's true.
They're dead. The train's not stopping, so you know, you can write. That's right. You can write till the cows come home.
I have two questions. First of all, you said right now. Okay, I'm with you on that. I tend to agree, but if not now, when? When do you think any of this might actually come to a head, John?
I mean, this is like a really like terrible answer, but it depends, right? But I mean, humans are pretty resilient. Right. I mean, if you think about like I said, Al Gore training, right? We've had like automated flight system. I know it's like multiple orders of magnitude more complex, but we've been living with automation. Now, again, go back 50 years and think about somebody explaining to you that we're going to let planes fly themselves. Right. You'd be like, oh, you kidding? That's insane. What if the plane, you know, I remember when I sold Chef, I'd go to these old Linux, you know, sort of like stodgy sysadmins, and they'd be like, what if Chef just starts creating servers? What if it just starts deleting servers? I'm like, yeah, it's probably not going to do that. And again, I'm not comparing what Chef does to what, like, you know, sort of a GPT-4 does. And completely different universe. My point is that we've been living with algorithmic compute power forever, and humans are very resilient. I think we'll just sort of maintain, we'll figure it out, we'll absorb, and we'll sort of adapt.
But I think there's also going to be a lot of pressure politically, you know, how do we regulate? Who's deciding what's ethical, what isn't? And going back and forth with that, because as we know, you know, there's always a human behind the AI originally that's putting all the data in. So going back to the idea of regulating ethics, that's going to be also, as Alan said, the train is going, I think that's going to evolve pretty much at the same time, or maybe behind it.
We can't regulate human ethics, so it makes you think you're going to regulate AI's ethics. Here in the U.S., we have no political will to get things done. The EU might, but certainly Russia and India and China and Iran and the Axis of Evil and all these other things, you think they give a crap what any of these people say? They're going to use AI to their own best benefits. And if it comes up and swallows them one day as a result.
Oh, well. Second question, John. You were talking about putting the controls in and the routers around the edges to prevent anything from spinning out of control. Humans are going to do that. So do we need some way to make sure that those things are actually operating? Because last time I checked, humans make more errors than machines. So
And we're both equally going to make mistakes, right? I think it goes back to our resiliency, right? Like, how did somebody like Barclays learn to build? In fact, so at some of these large financial institutions, they actually have like a two-factor human to turn a border switch off, right? They didn't do that day one, right? They had some real bad issues with Al Gore's going nuts, and over the years they've built these incredibly complex systems, you know, like literally heartbeats within the exchange, heartbeats without the exchange, I think we're going to adapt to these things that are going to be mistakes. And there's going to be a ton of mistakes. There's going to, one of my biggest fears right now is, you know, as we're accidentally putting, this is the more scarier thing, is as we're sort of interacting with these things, we don't know what our organization is putting in these models. Now, they say they don't train on your data, but they don't know for sure. So I don't know that we're not going to find out sometime later this year or early next year that somebody at JP Morgan Chase is going to be typing in something and they're going to get output from Goldman Sachs. Or even worse, an adversary will go say, I'm in funds at JP Morgan Chase. I work in 33 Broadway and I would like to know how to configure the servers for fun, and it will answer the question. I think that's more likely to happen than the computer basically turning off all our lights and making us pay a ransom to some.
And that may happen once or twice, and they'll figure it out and fix it. You know, they'll put in some safeguards or whatever. But let's not. You know, invoke images of Guardians of the Galaxy coming in here
How transparent should we be with folks about how that process is evolving? Because let's be honest, we're doing a lot of trial and error here. And a lot of it is, you know, not an experiment in a lab, it's live. And so I don't know if we're being candid enough with the average person.
I'm not a fan of Elon Musk, and I wrote an article recently in defense of his lawsuit. If you read the lawsuit, it's pretty interesting. Now, again, like I can go down a list of all the reasons I don't like Elon Musk. And, you know, Alan, you know this, right? Mm-hmm. But I think his, you know, and whether he's doing it for his own gain, he owns that X.ai, he's an investor in X.ai. Does he want OpenAI to just expose the model so that he can learn things? But at the core of what he's saying is, and he had this argument with the founders of Google, you know, there's a great article that in some ways, I think he believes what I think a lot of people believe is the transparency is going to be in the openness. And unfortunately, right now, the frontier models, you know, the GPT-4s, the Gemini, the Anthropics, Claude, those are not open. And you could argue somebody who's like a data scientist might be listening to me going, hey, that idiot doesn't know. It's really hard to train. I know that. You know, like it's not simple to take Claude's, but at least we have a fighting chance, you know. And so I think the transparency really has to be driven by like opening up these models. And if right. And so, again, the opposite thing of what the Gladstone report said, it shouldn't be that we need to, outlaw open source advanced models. It's I think it's the opposite. Right.
So, John, let me set you at ease. Elon Musk does nothing that's not for his own benefit.
I know.
And this lawsuit is strictly for his own benefit. You know, he wouldn't mind if it wasn't open as long as he had access to it. But the world doesn't have to be open. That you know, again, you think Russia's going to open up what they're doing on it? You think China's going to open up what they're doing on it? Or any of these folks?
But at least,
come on. Why should we have to play with one hand tied behind our back so we could cede the leadership to these other geopolitical rivals?
Do we want to get real meta? Because that's what we do. We're better at being humans than some of these other cultures.
They're all humans. Humans come in all shapes and sizes and colors and
we're
persuasions.
Going down left field, but I think it's our responsibility to do it the right way.
So what about, we've seen in the past with open source, right? Eventually it supersedes in terms of innovation the thing that came before. So Linux
is the only reason to do it.
Right. Well, then it may come down to the point where everybody collectively contributing to an LLM may accelerate the pace at which a proprietary LLM can advance.
Perhaps. And if it will, it will. But to think we're going to do it for some super sense of ethics, we're not communists, right? We're not a society of atheistic saints. At the end of the day, market forces will control this. And if there's a lot more profit to be made, it'll be made.
Government forces will control it too, right? There's market forces.
The government has the will to control it.
But I mean, that's my point, is there might be...
You don't think the market forces have a say on what the government's forces do through lobbying and everything else? Come on, who's being naive now, Kate?
No, I mean, but what I'm not being naive about is the idea that the collaborative nature of people trying to understand what these things do is going to be our best defense.
Absolutely.
Of understanding.
Absolutely.
And at least having, if the AI is inevitable, and I don't know, I'm not smart enough to tell you if it is or it isn't, but I do think least having fighting chance would be having models that at least the collective of millions of people could at least try to understand in the aggregate.
All right. AI tells us we got to take a break here.
Well, 1 second here. In the immortal words of Arnold Schwarzenegger, we'll be back.
Okay.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
All right, as promised, we are back, and we're going to be talking about the invasion of the drones. Turns out that Walmart, Chick-fil-A, and 7-Eleven, and all kinds of folks these days are experimenting with drone delivery, and they're going to have all these drones that are going to be flying around our neighborhoods, dropping off your lunch, and all kinds of fun things that will go with that. But I guess my first question is, and I'll throw it to you, but, where are all these drones going to fly around, and how are they not going to fly into each other? And
or into other things.
Right. Or do we need congestion pricing for drones now?
Shades of George Jetson. Yeah. You know, when I used to watch the Jetsons, that was always something I thought about. Like, there's no traffic lights or lane markers. Right. How do they not collide? You know, now theoretically, the drones using some superhuman AI might be able to avoid, you know, by talking to each other or whatever. But I really feel like we have to give Amazon credit here, right? Because Amazon came out with drone delivery or started talking about drone delivery, I guess it had to be 7-8 more years ago. And everyone said, nah, never happened, never happened. Well, it's happening. It's here. I mean, if we could deliver bombs with drones, we should be able to deliver groceries. But there's going to have to be some autonomous driving ability built into these drone deliveries so that we don't, you know, you're going to have congestion. But I would imagine, you know, nothing works perfectly. You're going to have collisions.
Well, that's what I was going to say. One of the other X factors here is the weather.
Yes.
How are they going to navigate through hurricanes, storms? I mean, I guess that's mostly when people like to, when they're stuck home during a storm, like to order food. But when you have strong winds, this is a big issue with planes.
Well, but I could see that. But you could write software for that really easy, right? You have a wind detector. If it goes over 20 knots, doing my nautical thing, boom, go to the ground. Right. And don't start back up until you get an okay or whatever. You could build those safeguards in. I'm more worried about Mike's drone. He got a cheap drone from some third, you know, rate country and it stopped working good. And all of a sudden it goes berserk and takes out my beautiful Walmart drone.
This is your boating issue, isn't it?
Yeah. This is boating. Yeah. Well, but it's the same thing with autonomous driving and trucks and everything.
Yeah. It's a similar issue. You know, you guys remember a couple episodes ago, I was telling you about a presentation I saw from the DOD about military drones. And their biggest problem right now is the problem is there's no collective or collaborative intelligence. So like when we see these spectacular things with drones where they light up the sky and create, you know, images of Penn State University or whatever, right? They're all individually programmed. And this is a similar problem with autonomous vehicles. I'm not an expert there, but like one of the hardest problems of collective autonomous vehicles is how are they all aware of each other? And so the thing I would sort of question is if DOD is trying to build, you know, weaponry around drones and they're struggling because they can't get everything's proprietary. They're trying to build open architectures to try to get people who create the technology for drones to start creating open, you know, collaborative capabilities and frameworks for these things. I'm not sure what, you know, what the vendors, you know, the e-commerce vendors are going to do in that regard. Are they going to struggle with the same thing? Are they creating collaborative nature because if Chick-fil-A just sends out their drones, Amazon sends their drones, and they're all working on different networks and they're not communicating, then, you know, regardless of the weather, they're going to be smashing into each other.
Yeah. Target's going to deliberately smash into the Amazon drones, right?
Yeah. And you also have
the army. They'll take the military route. They'll take out, there you go. That'd be a good sci-fi, like Target taking out Amazon delivery services. So,
well, you also have the human factor into, let's say you're getting your food delivery, wrong order, your neighbor sees the drone, says, gets the drone to come to their house. I mean, there's a lot of things that could also happen with
hacking
the human factor.
Yeah,
hacking the drone.
Well, hacking drones is one thing. Or, you know, up in the Appalachian Hills, some drone's flying by my property and I'm the Hatfields and he's headed to the McCoys. I'm going to shoot that sucker out of the sky.
I might just do that for fun.
Or and just if you're
people, right.
You or know, if you're hungry.
Get that BB gun from Christmas Story and let's go drone shooting.
So I'll tell you what I am really dubious about, though. So we can't even figure out an algorithm that consistently manages traffic flow in a city as it is. This is with cars and lanes and things that are reasonably structured. So I don't see how we're going to manage drones who can go any which way they want in any kind of collective fashion.
Except they are computer controlled. So you could say, look, all Walmart drones have to fly at 2,500 to 2,600 feet. Mm. Chick-fil-A drones get 1,500 feet. Amazon drones fly it. So you have that three-dimensional kind of aspect to it. Speeds, you know, pathways. So you can, you know, using a grid like that, I think really kind of segregate your traffic a lot more you can than on a city block.
Yeah, but how do they drop this stuff off?
Well, that's a whole other story. I think you got to start making drone ports on top of your house or your porch or something.
That's the collective, right? I think that's the problem that DOD is dealing with. Like, you know, how can you manage these things at scale? And you're going to they're going to have to be a network of intelligence,
superhuman AI.
According to DOD, it doesn't exist yet for drones. At least according to the presentation I saw.
Is kite flying going to become illegal then? Because I gotta like only have a certain amount of space.
You know what? Kite flying is illegal in certain airspaces. You're talking to someone who grew up near Kennedy Airport. I know this. So it has been illegal, and I guess it will be, unless the kites have AI and kind of intelligence built in them to avoid drone avoidance. It's a crazy world. It's a crazy world we live in. And my biggest thing is, given all of that, are they, you know, we're going to put all of these Amazon drivers and all these, you know, DoorDash people and this whole thing out of business by drones. Is it really that much more efficient? I don't know.
Well, it's another thing that might be driving it is not only that the AI and the technology, but the movement to be more sustainable, less traffic, less transportation, less emissions. One of the problems in cities is you have all these delivery trucks double parked. It's more congestion. So they want to have more bike lanes. I just lived in Manhattan, so I know this was an issue there. So I think that that's part of what's behind it. How do we get more cars off the road? Okay, we'll get them in the air.
Yeah. Well, why stop at drones then? Let's go full on Jetsons, right? And have flying cars. That would be cool.
Sounds good.
I think that was coming. At least it was promised like 25 years ago.
25. We're older than that, Mike. It's closer to 50 years ago. But anyway, yes, it was. And, you know, I want my flying car, God darn it. Anyway, we got to take a break here. We're going to be right back on Tech Strong Gang. And we're coming back with some Echo Insight green news. Stay tuned.
DevOps.com is the number one online destination for DevOps education and community building. DevOps.com covers all aspects of DevOps, including DevOps best practices and tools, DevOps culture, DevSecOps, business impact, continuous testing, continuous delivery, and more. DevOps.com has the largest collection of original DevOps content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.devops.com to learn more. DevOps.com, where the world meets DevOps.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Tech Strong Gang. Well, now we're talking about sustainability. And as organizations strive to be more sustainable, a lot of folks are wondering, where do we begin? How do we know how much carbon we're emitting at this point? And then once we do know that and we can measure it, then what? And Dynatrace has offered some great solutions about how to do this with their new Carbon Impact app. And I recently spoke to Klaus Enzenhofer, who's the product lead of business analytics, to talk more about the challenges and the capabilities of implementing this app with Dynatrace.
You have to balance between customer experience, availability of IT systems, business needs, SLAs, and all of that. And with that, you are adding carbon to the mix as a part of the game. And you have to balance out between these dimensions. And the beauty is you have to have everything in context of IT systems and give every stakeholder a different perspective. Because when you think about it, you have green engineering, green coding, which is aiming for optimization done by developers, by engineers. And you have these initiatives do go into IT operations as well, where you try to optimize the data centers that you're running, the machinery that you have there. All that needs to work together in order to really produce a reduction. But everybody needs to have the same KPI in focus. Everybody needs to have the same view on the state of the corporation, and that way, really step by step, optimizing the carbon footprint.
You know, Dynatrace also says that there's a lot of global mandates that are happening, and that's one of the reasons that they've moved towards this app. And it's really interesting because it's bringing more attention to IT departments, which a lot of people are focused on, and how we can go ahead and take the insights that the app provides and then make these changes and also report back to shareholders regarding ESG, which is a big commitment as well. So
sure.
Do you guys think that we're seeing a lot more of this? I think we are, but
I wonder if it's going to be like going to the restaurant now and everything has a calorie listing on it, right? And every little thing. And so maybe every little thing is going to have some sort of carbon counting mechanism on it where we're all going to know exactly, you know, how much quote unquote harm we're doing to the environment. And maybe we're all going to owe carbon credits or something because, you know, somebody has to offset that and becomes part of your digital wallet. But you know, you can imagine how far it can go. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying.
I've seen that with shopping.
Already starting to see it. I'll tell you, you know, we're just back from Europe. We were out in Paris for KubeCon, and then I did some other traveling through Europe. And I'll tell you, they're much further ahead than we are on this. And they're already thinking like that. What is the impact? You know, I went for a dinner boat cruise in Paris. And a big selling point is the boat that I went on was all electric. And the amount of carbon it saved versus a non-electric boat. And that was their major, and it had really good food. But that was a major selling point. And there were plans within Paris to make all those boats electric. And they had, that one boat saved something like 540,000 tons of carbon a year by doing that. And if they did, if they all of the boats were electric, the amount of savings was substantial. So I think that's the world we're living in. Yeah, we're moving towards. If we're going to be successful, we need to do this.
Then you got Sam Altman wanting to do the $7 trillion project, which is basically going to be a massive, they're talking about GPUs that, I think what's interesting, I think what Dynatrace did, which was fabulous, right? Like, I've been waiting for somebody to do this. I have a friend of mine who talks about this all the time. Like, could we actually calculate the carbon footprint from you can get those APIs from Google and Amazon. But the areas that I think we're just getting such a tip of the iceberg is like, what about all the mainframe use in a corporation? What about all the use of Workday, all the SaaS's, the ServiceNow, Salesforce.com? And then now add, how do we even come close to calculating the carbon footprint of co-pilots? I don't think there is an API for any of that. There isn't a calculation. I think the real answer is some of the research I've been doing on how data center taking advantage of, composable data centers and rethinking how we're sort of building the infrastructure. That's where we're going to basically get, because like what Alan said earlier, it says all the time and earlier is that, we're not going to stop this train. I mean, right now, the NVIDIA GPUs are scorching the earth. until somebody figures out a better way to do AI. We are just consuming power at an alarming rate. In fact, some of my research is that, that it used to be heat was a concern. Now it's a major concern in data centers.
Yeah.
Right. But there's some interesting stuff going on. I was going to write some articles for you about this stuff, but there's really, really interesting stuff going on that. So I think calculating and sort of ESG and having, having metrics for your carbon footprint it's like anything else. Like it's good.
Right. And the good more is good. I think, it's interesting. Dynatrace also put out some statistics that I thought were interesting about moving your workload to the cloud can reduce the carbon footprint by up to 96%. And when we also talk about carbon emissions and what's the biggest problem? Transportation always comes at the top of the list, especially the airline industry, for example. They found that cloud computing has a greater carbon footprint than the airline industry, and average cloud server idle time exceeds 70%. So there's a lot more pointing towards this is something that needs to be done. I think generally as a general population, we definitely have our eyes on transportation. In our last segment, we were talking about drones. But the amount of energy that that's going into the IT carbon footprint. The focus is on measuring it. And then how do we, what are the plans that we can make to reduce it? So some of it involves recycling, and rethinking how we do with do away with waste. That's a big issue as well.
And the reason that footprint is reduced is that these organizations, you know, Google and Amazon, they really focus on composable infrastructure so they don't waste. I mean, the problem that most large organizations have is their, you know, their CPUs are idle, but they're still paying power for it, right? Because they don't have really good sort of InfiniBand and infrastructure in place that doesn't starve the CPU. And that's the biggest problem with GPUs right now is there's sort of this GPU starvation, is that now these things are like power hungry, like compute hungry. And you know, like you're paying that kind of power tax on a GPU versus a CPU, and it's basically idle 60% of the time because you can't get the storage and the memory and the shared memory. So anyway, again, that I think that's, for people who are still going to run their own data centers, their sort of advantage is, you know, trying to figure out how to create composable infrastructure so that you can sort of make use of, you know, sort of the storage, the CPU, all those things. And again, that's really fascinating stuff going on right now.
I think networking has a big part of this conversation because we saw early on people were building data centers in places like Iceland or upstate New York near water sources. But then it became an issue about how quickly could I access that compute over a network. It was too slow. So you saw kind of a shift back to more metropolitan areas where I was closer to where people were consuming the data. If we want to build more efficient data centers, whether they're in Canada or wherever else, we got to have better networks because otherwise we're stuck.
Agreed.
Well, that's the thing about the sort of composable, right, which is the bottleneck is the storage to compute or the memory to compute, right? Or and so being able to create sort of multi-channel environments where you can literally have high speed, high bandwidth, high, you know, that's going to sort of reduce, in a sense, reduce the power consumption because, you know, you're getting more value. If you're running, you know, a million GPUs, and they're only based, and they're being starved 60 or 70%. I don't know the exact numbers. You know, what would happen if you didn't starve, if you could get their sort of utilizations up to 70, 80, 90%, you know? And again, that's, I think, what, you know, what Google and Amazon have perfected over the years is the ability to build network and infrastructure like that.
You know, that's typical of sort of first generation early on stuff. Like first you want to get just the functionality, then you start optimizing. So I, again, John, to your point about ingenuity of human minds, I think that'll be the, you know, Gen 2, Gen 3, Gen 4 will continue optimizing and making them more energy efficient, letting them throw off less heat, you know, because someone will build a better mousetrap otherwise. And that, again, market forces at work there.
All right. So buy land in Northern Canada today so you can sell it to somebody who's going to build a really big-ass data center tomorrow.
Or it could be beachfront in 50 years.
You know,
I don't know. The climate change might not be good for beachfront.
If any of people listening, their kids are going into engineering, you know, a friend of mine, Pacific Crest, who gave me a whole bunch of analytics on this whole subject, he said that right now, one of the hottest jobs is a job that people weren't even taking, is getting trained in heat transfer engineering. It's like, you know, something that nobody really cared about for the last 10 years. And now all of a sudden, it's probably one of the hottest positions you can get, you know.
Crazy. You know, that begs the question of the jobs of tomorrow. All of these things that we spoke about today, superhuman AI, drone delivery and regulating and controlling, you know, at scale, carbon footprint and measuring all of that, they're going to create jobs that don't exist today.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. But the John's point, the guy driving the HVAC van around town, you ever see those guys?
Yep.
He's laughing all the way home.
Yeah, totally.
You know what? You're still going to need those guys too. Absolutely. Anyway, if we don't have anything else, I think that's going to call a wrap on today's Tech Strong gang. Stay tuned. We have a full Tech Strong TV schedule for you for the next couple hours. And then we'll be back tomorrow with another fresh episode of the Textron Gang. Until then, John, thank you very much. Bonnie, Michael, thank you very much. This is Alan Schimmel. We're out.